Welcome back to this podcast recorded for the British Film Designers Guild Awards 2024. Today I talk to the winner of the Lifetime Achievement Award. This award honours art department members who've had a long and extensive career and have made their creative mark on the industry, benefiting their department as a whole. The winner for this award is chosen by the BFDG committee, and this year's winner is Martin Childs, best known most recently for his work on The Crown. So the 13th BFDG Production Design Award, supported by Ben Labs Lifetime Achievement Award winner, is joining us now on the podcast. I'm delighted to be joined by Martin Childs. Congratulations on the award. You have a wonderful story about how you became, you know, part of this industry. You started outside of it. Tell me how you came into the industry and why the third man was so important to you.
Well, what happened was I began with my father, actually, because he was, after he was been wounded, he was stationed in Vienna. So he was always banging on about this film called The Third Man, which was never available to see in the way it is now, you know, when it comes out in a new edition every few years on DVD. And so it was there at the back of my mind. I knew nothing about it. I was halfway through an architecture course. I got a degree out of it. And I was going, I thought I'd really prefer not to go any further because I was designing tin boxes on the outside of Huntingdon and I wasn't very, very happy doing this in my year out. And at the same time, I wasn't exactly bunking off, but at every possible opportunity, I'd be going to the cinema in Cambridge. And my dad got wind of this and he thought I should see a proper film. So he took me to see, there was a single one-off screening of The Third Man at the ADC, the Amateur Dramatics Theatre in Cambridge. And I went to see it and I just thought, this is a great turning point for me. This is, in retrospect, I suddenly learned how stories are told in film. And it was probably that and seeing Billy Wilder's Double Indemnity on TV at around about the same time, or possibly a bit earlier, that made me realise that actually people need to build the sets for these, design the sets for these so that they work and find the locations where Harry Lime can be lurking in a doorway and a cat who only loved Harry.
It's so brilliant that you've got such a specific memory of the moment in which the sort of light bulb went on. You've also talked about being obsessed with reading Hitchcock Truffaut, which is this kind of seminal text that people who are fascinated by cinema will go back to time and time again. Tell me what that is and why it appealed to you.
I think it was Hitchcock sort of explaining why and how he told the stories. I mean, now it's sort of known that perhaps he was stretching things a little, that he wasn't being perfectly honest.
Surely
he was
not.
Creating
Surely
stories
not.
That sort of built up his own image. And that's fine. I promise I'm not doing that by naming one specific film that was the turning point in my life. But anyway, I lived in St. Neots. I would get the bus to Bedford where a new film opened. I would get the train to London and I would see it. And in the time spent waiting for the start of the film, I would go and sort of browse in Foyles. In the days when Foyles was that crazy place where you had to go and take your book to the counter, they would give you a ticket, you'd take your ticket to the cashier and then you'd pay for the book. And one of those books was Hitchcock by Truffaut and it was in a beautiful little, I still have the paperback because it's become more than, I've got a hardback copy of it now that I can, is my reading copy, but the paperback is my sort of precious icon of a time when my life changed.
And how did your career progress from working on Blue Peter to working on feature films with Kenneth Branagh? I mean, what's the short version of that route?
I promise I'll try and make it short, but the great thing about the BBC then was it was a fantastic training ground. It had a pretty big design department, and I went there as what's laughingly called a holiday relief design assistant. And in that role, you're sort of given a designer to work with.
Yeah.
And occasionally you're given shows to look after yourself. They call it designing, but in the case of Blue Peter, it was so established and without a budget that there wasn't much designing to do. You just sort of put the set in on one of the recording studios and made sure it worked. And occasionally brought in things for special occasions like Sarah Green dressing up as a Victorian woman standing in a picture frame. So things like that actually have pretty much no budget. And you would alternate between these dramas. So if you were lucky enough to get one of the bigger dramas, which Tim Harvey, who's the most wonderful designer, he took me on as his assistant, first of all on Bleak House, which was the Denham Elliott, Diana Rigg version from the 80s, and later on Fortunes of War, which is where Ken Branagh and Emma Thompson played the lead, the two leads. And as a result of that, we got friendly with Ken, and Ken was deciding to remake, well, not remake, but make in his own way, Henry V.
Yeah.
So Tim and I, Tim invited me to do it. We were still members of staff at the BBC, and so we took unpaid leave and kind of left via the back door and never said goodbye to anybody and never returned. And as a result of that, we did Peter's Friends and Much Ado About Nothing and Frankenstein. And it was then I kind of got an offer from Ken Adam to work with him as his assistant. And from then on, I went my own way.
One of the lovely things on the night of the awards was they had this showreel of your work. And I was so delighted to see Frankenstein in there because I loved Frankenstein when it came out. It got a terrible ride from the critics. I remember Ken Branagh saying that he toured the world with it. And he said it was like a, it was an endurance test that, you know, people would sort of, they were so kind of angry about the film. Now, of course, it's really found its feet weirdly on sort of Laserdisc and then DVD. The thing about that film was it always looked magnificent, even though it was perhaps too full on for some critics, I think. It had that gothic, heightened, hysterical, overcooked feel. It looks to me like it must have been a joy to work on. Was it, or was it a nightmare?
It was an absolute joy to work on. It was fantastic, yeah. I mean, it was overcooked deliberately. I mean, that was part of it. It wasn't ever intended to be the subtlest film. It was never intended to be anything like Past Lives. So it was, as you rightly say, full on, and it was great, great fun to work on. Just the joy of working with people like Richard Briers and Robert De Niro on the same film was a fantastic thrill. And also our dummy creature, when Robert De Niro wasn't around, or the dummy creature that could get thrown around and the dummy creature who was kind of constructed. We used to refer to him as Rubber De Niro. that was filling the place with you know, bottles and experimentation and stuff, and all of that scientific stuff was, yeah, it was a fun thing to do.
And what about working on The Crown, which again turned out to be another hugely successful over a period of years series? How did that evolve for you?
Well, what happened was I was working on Bill Condon's Mr. Holmes. And I got a call from my agent to say Stephen Daldry would like to meet via whatever Zoom was in those days. It was probably something else.
I think it was phone call by then.
It was probably phone call. It was some kind of visual thing we were seeing. We would have seen one another, and I would have shown him pictures. Anyway, I got home to find our poor old cat, aged 19 and three quarters, in a fairly poor state. So I tried to get my priorities in order and phoned the vet first, and then my agent. Resulted in the poor old cat dying, and I called my agent the next day and I said, I may have scuppered that job with Stephen Daldry. Is there any possibility of meeting again? So she looked into it and called me back and said Stephen had forgotten about the meeting. So I kind of have my poorly cat to thank for that. So as a result of that, we just met face to face 2 weeks later, and I thought, in memory of my cat, I'm going to do the most fantastic presentation. So I met Stephen and got the gig there and then. It was something that I thought might last two seasons and 2 years, and then it began to grow and grow and grow, and I thought maybe I'll do the next season, maybe I'll do the Olivia Colman season, and then it got to the stage of I might as well finish. And I was having such a great time as well, because everything I was designing was sort of going through time. And not only that, it was my own personal memory of things as well, because I was born soon after the Queen came to the throne. My memory of stuff formed part of the research, which was not anything I've been able to say before on any other project.
When you look at the track record of people that you've worked with, you know, John Madden or Mrs. Brown, Shakespeare in Love, you worked with the Hughes brothers, Mark Herman, but who are your favourite collaborators? Who are the people that you sort of still cherish?
I cherish every memory of that. I mean, there are one or two who possibly aren't, but I won't go into names. Person probably only has one name anyway. And I, yeah, all of them. I mean, all of them. It was a great joy to work with John, you know, three times. And the Hughes Brothers was terrific fun because they used to, you know, get me to quote rap lyrics with my accent as a way of passing the time in the recce bus in Prague.
They're great filmmakers, the Hughes Brothers. Really great filmmakers. Aren't they just? I mean, I remember seeing Dead Presidents for the first time and just being completely knocked out by just the vigour of their filmmaking. And then, of course, from then on, they went on to do sort of really, really intriguing stuff. What do you think has been the key to the success of your career, other than the fact that you're obviously very talented and very amicable? What's been the key to your success?
Knowing that it's a collaboration. I know during my acceptance speech I made a joke about collaboration, but I actually do really, really mean it, that it's nothing if not collaboration. If you think you're an auteur who can do it on your own and these people are minions around you, then you're not going to get very far, because you need to know that you depend on a lot of people. And it's not just the people in your department, it's the people who are photographing your film. And I think, getting back to favourite directors, I have to give a mention to Phil Kaufman. You know, when I did Quills, I went to the meeting with him and we just got along really well. And I, as a kind of, there's always a sort of key thing to take along to one of these meetings. And my key thing was I found some 18th century pornography and I thought, this is quite Marquis de Sade. So I took it along to this meeting and he was thrilled by it. And at the end of the meeting, I thought, God, I hope I've got that job. And I soon found out that I did. And was giggling at the thought that I was working with the man who made The Right Stuff.
Yeah. And The Wanderers.
And The Wanderers.
It's a wonderful film. Yeah.
And indeed his remake of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which was a great favourite of mine. Anyway, cut to several weeks later and Phil admitted to me, he said, you had me at the dirty book.
I once interviewed Owen Roisman, the great cinematographer.
Oh, wow.
I've interviewed him a few times because he made some films that I loved. I was talking to him about The French Connection, and I said, you know, Billy Friedkin said that The French Connection, it was all shot with available light. And Owen said, yeah, well, you know what available light means? And I said, no. He said, it means whatever's available in the truck. And he said, most of the people who write about films do not actually understand anything about the way they're made. The fact that you even thought that that film was made with, in inverted commas, available light is laughable. Do you think, in terms of production design, that it's starting to change, that people in general, but critics in particular, and I speak as a critic, are starting to wake up to what production design really is in terms of film storytelling and being the world building at the back of all of this?
I think they are. I think it's weird that it's happening at the same time as all of that work is becoming more virtual than big budget films. I was terribly moved by, on the Oscars last night, I stayed up to watch the Oscars, when, what's his name, Cord Jefferson mentioned, you know, why aren't we making $24 million films or $54 million films rather than one $200 million film? And it's those films that still need precise, detailed production design and set decoration. They need that level of precision and choice and that sort of sparingness. I think one of them, I don't know what the budget was on it, but my God, a film, for example, like The Holdovers, was just fantastic to look at.
Yeah, yeah, it was a beautiful film to look at. And I remember when it came out, we were doing the radio show, and a lot of people wrote in saying, it was so fabulous that it was shot on celluloid. It wasn't. It was shot on digital to look like celluloid, which is one of the reasons why it's so, you know, the inventiveness is great. Also, that point that Cord Jefferson made about, you know, people think that it's risky to make low-budget movies, but surely it's risky to spend $200 million on a movie. Why don't you make 10 movies, you know, for a tenth of that? And I thought that was, it was lovely that he was talking about opportunity. Do you think that there are those kind of opportunities in production design? If somebody's listening to this and thinking, well, you know, I love the sound of that career and I love the way that movies look, is it a place where there are opportunities to find work?
I think so. I mean, one of the great things about working on The Crown was that I started off on it as production designer, therefore I had nowhere to go. But every single member of my department got promoted up a notch during those 10 years, until maybe after 8 years, one or two of them left. But they all stayed loyal to it, and they all got to learn a tremendous amount of stuff. And there one particular was a student, joined as an assistant art director, became an art director, is now, I'm not sure where he is, I need to get in touch with him, but he's probably designing something by now. And so there are opportunities like that, but I suspect The Crown might have been unique in that regard. I can't imagine any other TV show that goes on for 10 years. I've got a feeling I haven't answered your question, Mark. I'm sorry about that. But
no, you have. You've done so rather eloquently by kind of going round the side of it and coming in through the back door, which was great. All right, let me ask you a final thing. It seems to me that a lot of what you love about production design was rooted fairly early on in your experience of going to the cinema. You've talked about, you know, going to the Pavilion Cinema and the staircase and your memories of that. Now, I grew up near the Phoenix in East Finchley, and it became my church, and I remember going there just to see absolutely everything. Do you think that your talent for production design was basically hardwired in there when you were a kid? Because it still sounds to me when you talk like there's a part of you which is a kid being astonished by cinema.
Yes, yeah, I do think that. And I think you've recognised something that I haven't quite recognised myself, that sometimes when I have conversations with directors, I have to refer to a film, not in order to plagiarise it, but in order to show it as an example of how to tell a story.
Yeah.
And there's one sort of perverse moment of production design that I love, and that's getting back to Billy Wilder's Double Indemnity again, where Barbara Stanwyck goes to Fred McMurray's flat, and something that never, ever happens in real life happens there, and that is that the door swings out into the corridor so that you get her hidden behind it. Only we can see her. Edward G. Robinson is on the right, and Fred McMurray is in the middle. So those two are having a conversation with a concealed woman behind a door that really shouldn't be doing what a door is doing. And you've really got to have balls to do that.
Well, hence the phrase, what would Billy Wilder do? So,
yeah,
Martin, congratulations on the award.
Much.
I know it's for a lifetime of achievement, but you're still clearly right in the middle of all of that. So thank you very much for sparing the time to speak to us, and congratulations.
Many thanks, Mark. Many thanks. That was a great pleasure.
That was Martin Childs. This podcast was produced by Hedda Lawney Archbold at HLA Agency, and the editor was Benjamin Cook. With thanks to all at the BFDG.